So we're reaching the tail end of Hebrews, not that we've worked all the way through. We started virtually in the last third of the book. But the book of Hebrews probably was a sermon. It seems to read like a sermon. Anyway, its point is to encourage people to stay steadfast in the faith. And it does this by presenting and reminding people of the supremacy of Christ. Jesus is the sole option, or the by far the clearest, best option to approaching God. And he's writing to Jewish people who were being tempted to return back to their former way of understanding God as encoded in the Jewish scriptures and the sacrifices at the temple and the Levitical code. And so at this tail end, he's basically giving us a couple encouragements of how we might want to motivate us to stay firm, to hold the faith. He's already given us all the logic about why Jesus is so supreme and so sufficient. Next week, well, you'll also, if you go to St. Ambrose for the service, you'll also hear Hebrews 13 read, which is more a bunch of, now remember to do this and don't do this and do this kind of stuff. So we're really getting the end of his plea and his argument to secure the standing in the faith. And so we see some motivations for the Christian life or motivations for the Christian walk. I also think there's a third, so there's two I want to talk about from this chapter and this portion of chapter 12. And then there's a third that I think the gospel and Isaiah 58 have. So let's begin with fear, the fear of God. Now, what we heard, our translator said, since then we have this kingdom that cannot be shaken. So we've got this eternal, secure hope in what God is doing and our inheritance and our place in that. This God is going to shake the world and the heavens. All that's not of God is going to be removed, but we're in that peace that's of God, so it won't be removed. Since that's already our inheritance, let us have gratitude whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and awe, our translation said, which is really a mistake because the Greek word translated as awe is a word that means dread. It means terror. It's not one of these words you can give a good spin to. It means, you know, stupefy, you know, being stupefied by the enormity and the danger that you're in, or this great feeling of dread that settled over you. And we've lost sight, in part because it's been so abused in the past, we've lost sight of this healthy understanding of the fear of God. And I don't want to talk about that today. I have preached on that in the past. It's not the sermon for today. But if you want to chase that down a bit, just look at this. Our God is a consuming fire. We need to be fearful because our God is a consuming fire. That comes from Deuteronomy, God's statement to Moses, "You shall have no other gods before me, for I'm a jealous God, a consuming fire." And that'll give you some context for that. You can chase that down if you want to in your own, you know, on your own time, sort of work on this idea of how can we fear God? What should we fear about God? Is fear healthy? It's one of the motivations. For some people, they're connected to that's a sort of the prod or the impetus or the stimulus to keep them steadfast in the faith. You don't want to miss out, or you don't want to get on the wrong side of God. You need to fear God. Just like it is, I suppose, at home. Some of your kids, your children, if you had children, would respond more to fear. Others just rebel against that. It's not a good motivator. The other motivation we get here in Hebrews is this glorious picture that he paints, this contrast. He says, "You've not come to this mountain." So we remember what happened when Moses and the Israelites came out of Egypt. God delivers them with a mighty hand, takes them to meet with him and to strike this agreement, this covenant, this treaty, this contract. And God descends on this mountain in fire and storm and thunder and lightning and this majestic voice and trumpets blaring. And as great as that is, the writer to the Hebrews says, that's not your experience, and neither is it as good as what you've got. Instead, not having something localized, as significant as that was, you are actually entering into the very heavenlies. You've been called to the heavenly Jerusalem with an array of angels and festal gathering, all of the saved, all of the redeemed, all of those made justified across time and space. Abraham's there. Adam and Eve are there. Whoever, the list goes on. And across all nations, these have all come, and that's where you come. That's your place. That's the connection you have to Jesus himself. And he's reminding us of all he said earlier about how Jesus has opened a living way into the very throne room of God. He himself is our payment, our purchase price. Jesus is standing there saying, God, here's St. Barnabas from Medicine Hat. And God is saying, bring him in. That's great. And Jesus says, I bought these people. And God says, I know. That was a tremendous thing you did. And we're just all coming in. And we're part of this great thing. And God is saying, how do we celebrate St. Barnabas being here today? Let's throw a party. And they strike up the band. And this is another motivation. And this is something that connects with some of us, perhaps. Our imagination starts going. We're like, yeah, I want to be part of that. That is just great. Like, yeah, how would I let go of that? Like, if that's true, why would I do anything to jeopardize my ability to be part of that? Like, that's tremendous. I want to be part of that. And some people are going to connect more with that. And the writer of the Hebrews is giving us this motivation as well. He's trying to create a vision for us. He's trying to strike our fancy. He's trying to open our hearts and minds to this wonder and beauty and glory and entice us into it. And it may be, actually, I know some personality types are going to be more drawn to one or the other of these, and it may be true that all of us go through stages where that's more how we connect with God, is on this level of the excitement of all the good things he's done and a sort of confidence and robust belief in this. It may be true that you come and at the altar you see that in fact you're kneeling before the very throne of God because you're now in the heavenlies. That somehow Jesus has opened, that time and space have been made none. And that's where some people, there's Anglicans who believe this, and there's, I'm sure, Catholics who believe this as well. Especially during the Eucharist. That's why in our prayer we say, with angels and archangels and all the heavenly hosts, we raise our voices to proclaim the glory of your name. Comes right out of this vision in Hebrews 12. And that may work for you. There may be that connection. Sometimes you might be like, I can believe this. It happened to me today. Lovely thing. So fear and an idealistic sort of glorious vision that we imaginatively get excited about, these are both good motivators. Might be true, more true for us in certain stages of our life or not. But the third is in the gospel. This is what I want to talk about today. Because this, I think, has the potential, at least, of cutting across all personality types. Because it's the basic, lowest, common denominator. So let me paint that picture for you. Jesus, a wandering rabbi and teacher, ends up in this synagogue. We don't know where it is. But as is the practice, the synagogue is a worship service. There's a reading of scriptures. Our liturgy is modeled after the ancient synagogue practice, as far as we can tell, with the readings of scriptures and the psalms and all of this, and even the sermon. And so Jesus gets up and he says, here, I'm going to teach about this sermon. And the superintendent, the guy who oversees the synagogue, invites the visiting teacher in or to speak. And as Jesus is speaking, all of a sudden, and this is a romance story, right? This is a way to think about this. All of a sudden, Jesus is like, wow. He looks over, and there she is. And he's like, yeah, that's it. That's the one. This woman, bent over double, 18 years bound, a spirit of illness, a spirit of sickness. And Jesus looks past everyone else in the room. It's this magical moment, right? The romance scene. I want you to get this, right? The cheesy sort of TV show or whatever, or movie. Their eyes meet across the room and Jesus says, "Woman, you are released from your sickness." And then he lays his hands on her and she stands up straight. It's this beautiful picture. It's a picture of the heart of God, especially made clear when the synagogue leader responds by saying, "You know, it shouldn't be happening on, that's work. There's time to do these sorts of things. You need to." Now here's the thing. If you want to catch the eye of Jesus, well, here's what we do wrongly. We think, well, of course, if I want to please Jesus or want him to get to notice me. So we're playing the metaphor. Sorry, I apologize for how cheesy this is, but we're playing the metaphor of the romance scene, right? So you're like, yeah, I need to, you know, dude myself up or doll myself up and be able to catch the eye. But here's the thing. If you want to catch the eye of Jesus, you need to let your ugly side out. You need to quit hiding your brokenness and your woundedness, that spirit of illness that has gripped you these so many long years. That's the way God works. His love is always on the lookout for the one who knows they need him. Teresa of Lisieux, the little flower, she says, "I just make myself weak before God. I make myself small before God so that he has to help me. He has to help me. I'm not going to pretend I can help myself." This woman, 18 years, I presume you know what this is like. You're not the person people ask to help and to be involved and to, "Why don't you go speak on behalf of our synagogue at the local gathering?" You're the person that people tolerate at best. I'm sure there's a high degree of shunning associated with such an illness, such disfigurement. And this is the very person that catches the eye of Jesus. It's hard for us to learn this lesson. We think, and as good as these things are, and there's a lot of benefit in what we do to improve ourselves, and what we do to grow and to get better, to be gooder, but we mistake it when we say that's what Jesus is asking us for, so that he might receive us or notice us. We attract the attention of God when we are honest enough to let our brokenness show. This is the picture in Isaiah 58. We skipped over the first 8.5 verses. This chapter 58 is like the Magna Carta of groups like the Salvation Army and other social service groups. God says, "All your religious ritual means nothing to me." Is this fasting that you would sort of disfigure yourself and put on ashes? No, this is fasting that you open your heart to the homeless and the needy and the hungry. This is the heart of God. And Jesus shows us, of course, the heart of God. I was reminded of this verse in Isaiah 57, so just shortly before Isaiah 58. "I am the high and lofty one, says the Holy One, who inhabits in eternity. I dwell in the high and lofty spaces." And we know that, right? That's God. If we imagine it, if we're honest about it, God dwells where we saw this in Hebrews. up in the heavenly somewhere on clouds. He's got a train of thousands upon thousands of angels who do his bidding. A militant spiritual force and army. He's full of grandeur and light so that no one can approach him. He's inaccessible in light and glory. Majestic is his name. We know this. And then the verse goes on, Isaiah 57:15. I, the Holy One, dwell in the high and holy place, high and lofty place, and also with the broken-hearted and the lowly in spirit. Wow. I can't be that, but I can be that. If I want to be with God, where does he dwell? He dwells in the high and holy place. Yeah, how do I get there? I'm not sure. Jesus invited me. I'm not sure how that works on a day-to-day basis. And, says the high and holy one, I dwell with the contrite, the crushed, the brokenhearted, the lowly in spirit to revive the spirit of the lowly one, the contrite one, to heal the brokenhearted. So we get this backwards. It's hard for us. Everything else in life teaches us that we have to minimize our brokenness and maximize what we see as goodness, as strengths. How do we hear and how do we learn to do that differently when we come to God? And so inadvertently, we create barriers and blocks. The very thing is, we say to ourselves, I want to seek you, Lord. As the psalmist says, you said to my heart, seek my face. And my heart says, I will seek your face, O Lord. But by doing so, we begin to create barriers because we're trying to be better and gooder. We're trying to do our best. As Andre Loaf says, yes, I know you've done your best. That's unfortunate. If you did less than your best, you might find that that's the place where Jesus meets you. Everything has taught us to hide, conceal, and to minimize our brokenness. But it's our very brokenness that catches the eye of Jesus. Let me read for you from Andre Loaf. And you can blame Andre Loaf for this theme. I think I've been working for more than this sermon. He's talking about how healing and transformation cannot come from external things and from the law. None of these can purify or radically heal a person. Only Jesus can do this. Precisely to that end did he come, not for all the healthy who know all the requirements of the law, but for the sick. Not for the righteous who hide behind their obedience to the law, but for sinners. He did not come to seek the irreproachable, but for lost sheep. Jesus himself lives there in our heart. He lives in that wounded, bleeding heart, which he knows through and through, and which nothing can shock or disconcert him. He lives in that wounded, bleeding heart, which he knows through and through, and in which nothing can shock or disconcert him. He feels nothing of what seems so hideous to us and so improbable. All those shameful things, those things that we despise about ourselves, that we hide from in ourselves, these do not shock Jesus. Or those things that seem improbable, you know how that is. Why would I bother praying about this again? God hasn't done anything about this. It's an improbable situation. Why would I mention it? This woman, 18 years bound, is obviously not hoping that that Sabbath day she would be released. He feels nothing of what seems so hideous to us and so improbable, which seems so only because it has never yet been looked at with infinite love and respect. those hideous things, those improbable things, seem so to us only because they have never been looked at, not yet been looked at, with infinite love and respect. And this is what we see in this story in the gospel. Jesus looks with love upon this woman and treats her with respect and restores to her the dignity. He says, daughter of Abraham. This daughter of Abraham, should she not have been set free, released? And those things, it's ironic we hide these things because we think they disqualify us, and they're the very thing that qualify us for the gaze of Christ. He is not repulsed or revulsed or put off. He sees only with the eyes of infinite love and the dignity and the respect that is ours as children of God, daughters and sons of Abraham, but better yet, daughters and sons of God. Let's pray. So God, we know we can't open our hearts. This is just more words. Be pleased, God, if you're calling us at this level to receive your love, the dignity with which you treat us in our brokenness, then open our hearts. Amen.